The following presentation was recorded at a science workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Okay, DNA and heredity is an exciting subject. Whenever I get down to the nitty-gritties of the cell, I can't believe that there are still evolutionists out there. We'll talk about that a little bit as we go along. I have a skeleton outline for you. It has been fading, so hopefully you can still read it as we go through here. Understanding DNA and heredity. What I'd like to do first is open with a little bit of a discussion on the need for DNA, and I'd like to do that by discussing the growth of cells, specialization of cells, differentiation, and then reproduction. First of all, let's go with growth of cells. In other words, an organism that's already alive has to grow, right? In order for, in other words, a young acorn that is starting to sprout, it's going to have to grow to become a tree, right? So what will dictate the growth of those cells? What mechanism is there that coordinates the growth? See the point? In other words, those cells have to divide and grow. What's going to control them? Furthermore, when that acorn starts making a sapling, what's going to control the limbs that start going out? What's going to give it the characteristic shape? What gives all life character, right, characterization? But growth is important. Let's go then with the specialization of cells. In other words, if you looked at developing a zygote of any animal, it would be hard, probably even if you're a biochemist and embryologist, to tell exactly what kind of life is in this zygote. You only have several cells and they're starting to divide, right? So what power is there within this zygote that determines whether it will become a frog, a dinosaur, a man? See my point? Okay, that is determined by DNA. Furthermore, in your body, in my body, what determines that when these cells start dividing, that some of them will become an eye, some will become a nose, some will become a big toe, okay, some will become hair. See what I'm saying? What determines which cells will become what and what coordinates that activity? It is DNA. We'll talk about that. So that's specialization of cells. Now, in your body, in my body, if we're adults, okay, we need repair. Don't they tell us that about every 7 years or so, we have all new cells in our body? So what determines that when one cell dies, the next cell will have the same information that the cell that died has so that our bodies can keep on living, okay? In other words, our bodies are dying constantly. We're in a dying world. Cells are dying right away, or all the time. So as cells are dying, what is determining that the unit of life continues? And then, of course, reproduction is probably the most obvious need of DNA. When one organism dies, the organism dies, what determines that there will be life after the organism dies? You go outside and if you have a plant that's growing and it's going to die in the fall when the frost hits, okay, what will that plant leave behind? This is an annual, okay? The roots die, this plant dies. What is left behind to guarantee that plant will grow next spring? So somebody tell me, what's left behind? That plant can grow next spring. An annual that dies. It has to be behind a seed. But what is in that seed that determines that a jewel weed will come up? We were on jewel weed, a marigold, or I'm not sure if marigold's annuals or not. What is in that seed that determines that the new life that springs is going to turn into a seed? Impatience. I know impatience are annuals. I think you get the point. There has to be some unit of heredity that is passed on, or some unit that is passed on to the next generation. And that's the need of, that's why we have reproductive cells and DNA that's passed on, and we'll talk about that. Let's go a little bit into the history of DNA, kind of an exciting area. There was actually not a lot known of the exact material that caused the material of heredity was not really known. We knew that proteins were an integral part in heredity, the hereditary process. But we didn't know exactly what caused what transferred the hereditary material onto the next generation. And I have outline here. Actually, I have a picture to show you. Two men by the name of Watson, James D. Watson, and R. H. Crick. Watson was an American biologist, and Crick, a British biophysicist. And they were the first in the race for DNA. How many of you have read the story? It's an incredible story of scientific intrigue. There was a race. They knew that DNA was involved. They didn't know how. They didn't know the mechanism, the model. And these two young men, they were brash, daring young men. They wanted to be the first to claim the glory and the fame. And they worked around the clock. It was a race of science. And they worked around the clock. And they're the ones who came up with the model that we have today. The model that they assembled has been changed very little. It's been somewhat adapted and modified, but generally it's the same model. So let's go ahead and go into the structure of DNA, and we'll go with double helix. I suggest when you get to this point in the classroom, and Mel mentioned it is easy to keep going, but just wade in, dive in. And if you haven't taken it before, get a pile of textbooks all around you, read several. Sometimes it takes a while for it to click, but let's go with the structure here. Okay, we have a double helix. That helix means it's a spiral, so it's a molecule that spirals, and it is composed of three main components, which I will go in order here. A nucleotide. Oh, sorry, we're smudging here. Nucleotide consists of a sugar, a phosphate, and a base, and we'll look at these in order. Sugar, phosphate, and base. Now, let me put a little long up here. Okay, here this would be the definition of a nucleotide. We have a sugar, and in DNA, the sugar is deoxyribose. That's where you get the term deoxyribonucleic acid. So we have a sugar, which is deoxyribose, a phosphate group, and a nitrogen base group. And those are really those are the three ingredients here in our molecule. Now, I'm not a biochemist, and I didn't particularly relish chemistry when I was in when I had to take it numerous times. But a base, okay, is the fourth basic. So that's where we get our model. Let me just put a sketch up here of the model for DNA. I'm using the bottom of this here. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. And again, here's our model. You've, I'm sure, seen this helix arrangement with things maybe you didn't understand before. So let's take them one at a time here. We have the nucleotide, which would be the things in the middle. And I like to think of it as a ladder. Okay, so think of the ladder, the backbone of the ladder, the uprights, as the sugars and the phosphates. Okay, they make up the backbone of the ladder. And then the bases that point to the inside will make up the rungs of the ladder, so to speak. Now, this ladder is not only, so you have a ladder, the outside of the ladder, the rung, or the backbone, the sides of the ladder, the uprights are composed of sugars and the phosphate. And then in the rungs of the ladder would be the the bases are pointing in. Now, one thing that would probably be good, would be good is to, when you get to this point also, is have get out construction paper, and it helps if you cut models and put them together. And models are very expensive. You buy DNA models, they can get very expensive, hundreds of dollars, so I don't have one to show you. But this is the basic idea, a ladder. And not only does this ladder is the upright with the sugars and the phosphates on the outside, the bases in the middle, but it also is twists, it's spirals. Okay, so that's why we have the term helix, we call it a helix. Now, so if you get lost here on the chemistry, don't feel too bad. Phosphates, deoxyribos, nitrogen. Our chemists among us, they will be glad to explain it to you. But the main thing is to understand the structure, and once we understand the structure, we'll learn what why this structure is important. There's one more point here we need to make with the structure, and that is that the bases that point to the inside, the rungs, they bond specifically. In other words, we have bases. There are four bases in DNA, the nitrogen bases. They are adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. And these all, they bond specifically. Now, what I always enjoy doing at this point, and this is when I had to learn it, I learned it by using a mnemonic aid. Okay, so here again is another, these have their limitations. What do we think of when we see these models? We start thinking of two-dimensional molecules. Okay, this is a three-dimensional molecule. Okay, it has three dimensions to it. So this is how we have to do it to get an idea. So here we have our helical arrangement, our phosphate sugar backbone, our base rungs. And what I was saying is the A stands for adenine, the T for thymine, G for guanine, and C for cytosine, and they bond specifically. In other words, A, adenine, always bonds to thymine. And now what I was telling you too is it helps if you get a mnemonic aid together. And the way I remember this is at gold camp. At gold camp. So if you remember at gold camp, you remember that AT at gold camp, GC, guanine, cytosine. So that's a basic rule, okay? They always bond specifically. And if you can stick it in your mind, that cold can, you can remember which bases bind to which. There's a, it's kind of interesting. If you give your students mnemonic aids, they'll end up thanking you for it. Okay, and that's one thing I try to build up a list of mnemonic aids as you go through science. Another example would be the kingdom, phylum class. In other words, students have a hard time learning lists, and I did this when I was in school. The first thing I did when I got to a test often was I got a piece of scratch paper and I filled it out with all my mnemonic aids. My mother makes very good pumpkin pies on Thanksgiving. Then I fill in this, you know, whatever. So, if you get mnemonic aids, your students will thank you for it. Any questions so far on the structure? Again, we have this is a molecule, and it is in our bodies. We'll get into that here in a little bit, but we have the actual structure of this molecule. Okay, how many of you have seen a three-dimensional molecule sometime or another? Okay, that helps if you see it. Now, it looks puzzling because you have big bumps here and all over, but that's probably the realistic this is just what this is good for your students. It helps them. It helps drill into their minds the function of DNA. In other words, to understand the function of DNA, you have to understand the Oh, okay, that was an object lesson later, and he decided to... It's good. Thank you, Smiley. You had a question.
I was just going to say it's important to understand that the cytosine guana, either side, which allows four possible arrangements.
That's right.
Per side.
The bases can be ordered any way on either side. The only requirement is that they bond specifically to each other. In other words, right, you can have a cytosine on either side, but it must always bond with guanine. Right? Any other points or questions? Okay, let's go then with, now that we've looked at the structure of DNA, let's real quick talk about how DNA copies itself. And this is an amazing phenomena. I don't know that anything is like it in the world. Now, I'll give you some statistic here in a little bit, or some figures. Let's look a little bit at the need for copies. In other words, why does DNA have to copy itself? So every time a cell dies, okay, in your body, in other words, DNA, every cell in an organism has the same DNA. Every cell in your body, in my body, in every organism has the exact same DNA. Every cell must have it. Now, that doesn't mean that all cells use all the DNA, but every cell has the exact same copy of DNA. That means I could take a sample from my big toe. One cell in my big toe would have the exact same DNA as a cell in the back of my retina. You see what I'm saying? Every cell in your body has the exact same copy of DNA. That's why they're using this for forensics. If you leave behind a piece of hair, a hair or any part of your body, okay, they can take that in forensics and do some DNA sampling and supposedly link it to you. So every time a cell dies, it must leave a copy of its DNA to the next cell, okay, because DNA controls the cell. And it must be an exact genetic code. It must be the exact same copy. And if it wouldn't be the exact same copy, you could have alterations and an organism could probably be altered and die. So the DNA replication process, we call it DNA replication, when DNA reproduces itself, is astounding. I'll just quickly throw this overhead up again, and you can look at it. I'm not going to go into the bases too much here. Basically what happens is, if you think of it as a zipper, there's an enzyme that comes along called DNA polymerase, and it comes along and it unzips. It takes the hydrogen bonds between the way the hydrogen bonds between the bases and allows it to unfold. Then what happens is there are other enzymes in the surrounding, and this is happening in the nucleus, protoplasm, which take free bases, loose bases, and they connect them to the free exposed base on the ladder, and then they also form sugars and phosphates assembled. So think of it as a factory, okay? In other words, this is happening in a cell. When it's time for a cell to divide, or when one cell it divides before it dies, it has to make a copy. So the zip, it unzips, DNA unzips the molecule, and all kinds of enzymes are coordinating this. Okay, that's what I was saying. It's astounding how fast it does. So enzymes line up. How does a cell know that cytosine has to go to guanine? Okay, well, there's an enzyme there that controls it. Okay, how does it know which sugar and phosphates? They have two ends. How does it know which end to put where? Okay, so there are lots of enzymes working. And who? And by the way, what made those enzymes? DNA made those enzymes, right? So in a little bit, we're kind of coming around full circle. DNA makes the mechanism that makes itself. So soon you come, or not doesn't make the it makes the ingredients that come around and eventually help to replicate itself. Does anybody have a question right there? Okay. So we have the bases then from the protoplasm lining up according to the prescribed base. In other words, you have bases need to specifically bond. Adenine to thymine and cytosine to guanine. Any questions there? And then you, in other words, then you have a two new molecules before you have one. Let's go a little bit with the facts of this. In other words, this is occurring before a cell dies. How much DNA is in a cell? Well, in our bodies, we have 23 pair of
chromosomes. So they say that it takes, it can, in 1 second, it can unwrap 75 chromosomes. And you start doing that. You start thinking about how fast the cell does it. You know, you figure the rate of my, you figure the rate of cell division, and then figure out how much DNA in the cell, it becomes staggered. It would be somewhat like taking a cathedral that's packed to the ceiling with tangled up microphone wires, and, you know, or cords on the side. It would be somewhat like taking that and in a matter of seconds, unwinding it, putting two more together with it, and back up. So, in other words, the process is staggered.
Let's go then with the, so we have the need for copies. You understand now, or we talked about the how DNA replicates itself. And by the way, the accuracy is equally astounding. The accuracy of with which DNA does this can be mind-boggling. When one let's see, in other words, it needs to do this for each time, and if in one replication, or the duplication is so accurate, this is a quote, that it would correspond to a rate of error of less than one letter in an entire set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So you can imagine Encyclopedia Britannica, how many characters do you have in there? Like trillions, probably. Millions. So the rate of error would be similar to having only one in replicating that entire information that equals that entire set. Okay, so now that we looked at DNA structure, Okay, we looked at how every cell has that. We looked at how DNA replicates itself. Have we arrived yet at understanding it? No, not really. But before we can understand what DNA does, okay, we have to move on and look at proteins. Okay, proteins. And then, once we talk about proteins a little bit, we'll come back and wrap this up, at what the actual function of DNA. Let me talk a little bit about the importance of proteins, and that was going to be my little woolly worm here.
What makes this woolly worm and this acorn goldenrod? In other words, we have living things here, right? What makes our babies that are characteristic? And what is this one kind of life, this another kind of life, this another kind of life?
Essentially, it comes back to the fact that proteins are of utmost importance. In other words, most proteins are what makes a cell become what it does. Okay, the proteins are the cellular structure in the cellular structure. Proteins are what differentiate. In other words, let's look at when your body, like when we were a zygote developing. Okay, what makes one cell take on the characteristics of an eye? Okay, what makes a cell become a heart, you know, cell where it starts beating, or, you know, many cells come together? What makes all those cells do that? Okay, or how do those cells become things, I should say? What makes a cell become characteristic of a certain organ? It is the proteins that constitute the cell. In other words, in a cell, the proteins that are in the cell membrane, the proteins that constitute that cell itself, are what give it its function. In other words, that's the definition of the cell, is the protein that contains it. Most cellular and extracellular substances are proteins. And each cell in our body can have up to 200 trillion of these proteins in one cell. Okay, so in other words, proteins are not life, but proteins are what give a cell its function, its structure, and virtually every process. Proteins are the only thing that are different. In other words, if you take glucose. Glucose is glucose, whether it's in a plant cell or whether it's in your body or my body. See what I'm trying to say? Okay. Carbohydrates, lipids. But you take a protein, that's not true. Of course not. In other words, protein in my body is much different than a protein in an acorn. Okay. So proteins are the basis of character individualization. They're the basis for differentiation of species, of basically all your orders of life. So proteins are the cellular structure that give life variety. Proteins consist of amino acids, and they are twisted and looped together into what we call a polypeptide chain. Again, I'm not going into the chemistry here, organic chemistry. You have a good time here with amino acids and laws involved there. But proteins have a particular shape, and it is the shape that determines its function. Okay, so you have all these amino acids, and the amino acids are in a specific order. The order of the amino acids and their shape give that protein its function. So, for instance, if I were a protein in a liver, okay, I would have a function, in other words, the proteins in my liver have a function that's specific to, have a structure that's specific to their function. Okay, they would be very different than proteins in, in your stomach wall or something. So the structure, which is the arrangement of amino acids, dictates the function of the protein. Anybody have a question on proteins and structure and function? Let's go then with the requirements for protein synthesis.
Okay, in other words, what requirements are there if proteins are so vastly different and if they're so integral to cells, individual specialization, like mitochondria, proteins in the arm, right? And my, there are other proteins that make my arm very sensitive. What are the requirements for synthesizing so many different kinds of proteins? There are hundreds and thousands of different kinds of proteins in the body. So we need to have a mechanism for making these, right? So what is the mechanism? How will we make these proteins? So there are two requirements for making for proteins, making them consistently.
The mechanism that makes proteins, that controls how proteins are made, it must be one, flexible.
It must be exceptionally flexible, because it has to make proteins that they're what makes my eyes see? Okay. So the retina, back in my eye, what's the function of those cells? And what kind of proteins are going to be in that cell layer to help it catch light, turn it into
nervous energy? So it has to be very flexible. There are several thousand different proteins in our body, and the mechanism that makes them has to be able to make all the different kinds. Okay, the second criteria, it must be extremely stable.
Because when these proteins line up in the amino acid chain, they have to line up exactly the same every time for that protein to function as it's supposed to. If only one amino acid were out of place, it could change, it could alter the function of that protein. That protein may not work. And that's often what happens. If the organism starts developing some kind of cancer cell, different illnesses. But if the proteins do not function the way they're supposed to, or if the amino acid sequence is not exactly right, then the protein will function the way it's supposed to.
So the requirements for making proteins, which are the basis of the cell, right? That mechanism must be extremely flexible and extremely stable. So now that we understand the way that DNA is structured, the way that it copies itself, and the importance of proteins, we can go ahead and get into the function of DNA. DNA has bases, which we said are lined up, and the order of those bases constitute maybe what we could call an alphabet of life. In other words, the exact order of those bases code for a particular amino acid. Now, let me throw on a little diagram here that may help us understand this. In other words, in our language, the English language, we have 26 letters, and we put those together to make a sentence. We have 26 letters. Similarly, the language of DNA is composed of bases, the four bases, adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. We arrange letters to make words, the fox, dog, lazy, and so on. Similarly, the four bases in DNA are arranged, and we call a codon three bases. A triplet of bases we call a codon. Now, what happens is this. Just as we arrange words to make a sentence, similarly, the codons in DNA are arranged to make a polypeptide chain, which we went over, of amino acids. Okay, in other words, we take our words, we put them in sentences in an orderly way, right? So you understand what we're saying. That's the way DNA does. It takes the codons on the DNA molecule are arranged in a way so that when they make a protein, they line up the amino acids exactly in order. The amino acids are in the exact order. So when we get the paragraphs, we put, you know, sentences together and make paragraphs, and DNA puts bases and codons together to form a group of polypeptide chains and proteins, and that becomes a function of that protein. Let me go with, I mentioned the word codon. So there is a specific chart that you can, I'm sure you've seen in your high school books. In other words, every three bases here, let's take UUU, okay, that's called a codon, triplets. UUU will always code for this particular amino acid, always. That's the language of DNA. Take CC, where we at? CCC will always code for proline, this particular amino acid. So you understand? DNA has codes, has codons. The arrangement of those codons codes for a particular amino acid. The way the amino acids are lined up determines what? The arrangement of the protein, which determines the function of the protein. So it soon becomes obvious that the way the amino acids line up, that's everything. Okay, I mean, the way the amino acids line up, that's what makes protein a protein, which makes one cell do its function. So it is of utmost importance, the arrangement. And that's what DNA has, that information. That's why it's called code of life. DNA has the exact code which makes proteins, which makes the amino acids line up in the order they are needed for functional proteins. So I gave you code on there. Knowing that, though, is just the beginning, okay? Because where is DNA found?
Where is DNA found? It's found in the nucleus, right? So the nucleus of the cell is DNA, but where are proteins made? They are made in the cytoplasm, right? So how does the genetic code, okay, that's what we want, right? We want that word of codon. How does that information get from the nucleus to the cytoplasm, where the amino acid chain is going to be assembled and the protein becomes polymer?
So we need a mechanism to get the code, and this is where it's mind-boggling. I mean, if you're evolutionist, why did it have to evolve this? Why didn't you? I mean, in the DNA code itself, in a little while we're going to review it, or we're going to summarize it, and it is, to me, I cannot believe that there are actually scientists now who come to know the Lord by studying this. They are staggered. This cannot have happened. You look at the probabilities. So what we need is a mechanism to get the genetic code from the nucleus to the cytoplasm where the protein will be assembled, and RNA is what we use here. RNA is structurally similar to DNA. It is also a nucleic acid.
I didn't even tell you this at the beginning. The reason we call DNA nucleic acid is because it is found in the nucleus, right? So deoxyribose sugar, that's what we call deoxyribose nucleic acid. Nucleic acids are found in the nucleus, nucleic acid.
So there are, RNA is the mechanism or is the intermediate molecule that carries the information from DNA in the nucleus to the cytoplasm outside of the nucleus where the DNA or the protein will be assembled. Okay, so DNA does not directly manufacture a protein. It gives a message to someone else. So we call the RNA that takes the message messenger RNA. It takes the message from DNA to the cytoplasm where it will code for the, it will read the codes. Now it becomes backwards because RNA has to read the code from DNA, but it has to take the bases. And remember, bases don't, you can't just take adenine, okay, adenine, thymine, okay, thymine. It has to match up codons as well. So in RNA replication, we call it RNA transcription. What happens? Don't bother all the words here. In other words, here's the blue is the DNA molecule. So we have adenine, cytosine, you know these, right? So on. But there are complementary bases which must, and this is the newly forming RNA molecule. This is the molecule that's going to go out into the cytoplasm to code for protein. But it can't just pop in an adenine on, side or another. It has to have complementary bases. Furthermore, to make it more complicated, okay, RNA doesn't have thymine. It has uracil. So now your students are really shaking their heads. Oh, so once you get to this point, you've got to stop review. But instead of thymine, RNA has uracil, which lines up complementary. So now, this DNA, let's pretend this DNA here wanted to make a amino acid proline. Okay. What was proline? CCC, right? Okay. If this DNA segment right here wanted to make an amino acid proline, what would it have to code onto the RNA? Well, we still have guanine, so we code GGG, right? So then the transfer RNA molecule would go out into the cytoplasm, and it would have a GGG, and then the proper amino acid would line up to it. There are two other kinds of RNA. We also have transfer RNA and ribosomal RNA, and they both help in the construction of a protein. Each does its part. I'm not going to go into it too much here. Transfer RNA, though, brings the amino acid from the surrounding cytoplasm. Even here, though, it gets confusing because transfer RNA also has a codon which matches up, which has to line up with the messenger RNA codon. So there are enzymes in the cytoplasm that have to recognize, let's pretend now that this messenger RNA is coming out. It wants to code, proline, which was, it has to bring out a GGG. Now, the transfer RNA that brings the amino acid down to the assembling polypeptide chain won't have GGG. What does it have to bring down to the anticholon to call it? Has CCC. So what in the world, and when we got to this point, my students were like scratching their head. Well, how does this this transfer RNA that's bringing this down with the amino acid proline, how in the world does it know to bring proline down? In other words, there's an enzyme somewhere in the cytoplasm that has to know that transfer RNA needs or messenger RNA is calling for proline, which is what this transfer RNA needs to bring down. I was trying to think of an analogy for this. I couldn't really come up with one. The closest I could come to was maybe it would be like having there are 20 amino acids, and there are 64 possible codons. So
it would kind of be like having someone, a babysitter for 20 children, and they have 6-4 names, and it'd be like letting them into the Grand Central Station, having a fine 2 seconds, something like that.
So the mechanism of this whole thing is staggering. Okay, we have now that the genetic information is transferred to from DNA to RNA, and then that is what dictates really the function or the sequence of amino acids and the assembling of the protein. I think what we're going to do here, I want to quickly show you a micrograph of this actually occurring. By this time, your students always say, well, how do you know this is actually happening, right? So it helps if you have a few micrographs handy. Now, this is a micrograph of RNA transcription. That is the process whereby DNA is coding its language onto the messenger RNA to take out into the cytoplasm. So here is an actual micrograph of this occurring. Okay, in other words, here's a DNA strand. And from the DNA strand, you have the messenger RNA. Okay. In other words, when DNA is ready to encode its message, it unzips. Messenger RNA comes through and it gives its message to one strand only, usually, to the RNA, and the RNA strand is extending outward from the DNA molecule. And this is happening, here someone caught it on the micrograph happening in the cell. So we can see what's happening. Our model fits the information that we get. I just wanted to mention too about how that with this whole thing happening, it's phenomenal. There are probably, in other words, the same messenger RNA that's starting to code in the nucleus, it will then go through the nuclear pore out into the cytoplasm, and while it's still coding, it will probably start to make a protein to get it in there. And so these are all the same. So the same messenger RNA strand can make a protein one, and it can be assembled. The
nucleic
messenger RNA strands are used over and over again. When it breaks apart, the nucleotides are recycled, so that makes, in other words, it again.
All these parts are floating around the cell. Now, these aren't just, we don't have only these sugars, phosphates, and bases. We have everything else in the cell, too. So we have all this information happening. Grand Central Station is probably pretty thin compared to the activities itself. So what are all the mechanisms controlling this? What are enzymes? They're proteins. What mechanism makes proteins? DNA. So it all kind of comes around in full circle there.
Now, just one more point here that's very interesting. The particular codons for amino acids are universal, okay? C, C, C will always code for proline. Whether you're talking about a chipmunk or a dinosaur, well, we don't know if it's dinosaur, but whether you're a mouse or a roach or an eagle or you and me, okay? C, C, C will always code for proline. And that's consistent. So what did evolutionists want to tell you with that? They say, well, we must have a common ancestor if you have common amino acid code here. But let's go with, just while we're on that subject of evolution, I was telling you, I think it's astounding. While we're on there, let's talk about one of the smallest proteins. One of the smallest is ribonucleus, which is an enzyme that breaks apart the RNA strands. It's 124 amino acids long. So put your thinking caps on. Students always love to do that. So if it's 124 amino acids long, how many how long would the RNA molecule have to be that coded that protein? In other words, this protein is 124 amino acids. So how many nucleotides does the messenger RNA have to code? Well, you take 124 times 3, 372. And that's just a very, very small protein. And that protein only does one little thing. So can you see now how evolution becomes, in other words, this is where evolution has to occur, right on this level. So let's talk about a little more. Most proteins are thousands and thousands of amino acids long, functional proteins. And many of these don't have just one chain, they have many chains. And the chains loop and twist and form bonds which make those proteins functional in a specific way. So, what are the chances of a small protein? I have some figures here I want to read. If it takes a small protein, let's go to one that here. This one is 234. The smallest free living thing is 239 individual proteins. So the smallest free living organism on Earth would be somewhere around 239 individual protein molecules. So what are the chances that the first protein molecules would form all their amino acids to form just one protein in that individual, in that organism? It comes out to 410. The minimal number of amino acids would be 410. So that would be like flipping a coin, and every time you get, that's 410 times. Now, you put that times 239 individual protein molecules in the organism, soon you're going to get scientific notation. So this is where genetic, where evolution has to occur. In order for an individual to develop, and all, in other words, the genetic code, if it is followed, will always transcribe to the protein, will always be the same, which will always result in an organism that's the same, just passed on from one generation to the other. So for evolution to occur, those amino acids have to be out of sequence, they have to be shifted. We call that mutation. Right? So mutation, that's the basis of evolution. But if you look at the probability of a mutation occurring, and for the mutations to be beneficial, you soon become static. And there's one, Vince, I'm citing here. He says that an amoeba, if you take an amoeba, and it would have to carry one protein all the way across the known universe. His explanation gets kind of long. But if he travels only 1 inch, he would have to carry, his point is that the amoeba would have, the time it takes for the evolution to occur, the possibility, it would have to take, it would only get 1 inch from the time that the known, in other words, they get to the known universe, the amoeba would have only gone 1 inch. If I had lost you, I would have taken that. What I want to say here, though, about evolution is that there are the possibilities for it occurring. Even if they did happen with that through evolution. In other words, even if something is mathematically possible, I don't think that's even necessarily evolution. In other words, if you blindfold me and tell me to come to a 1 square inch in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I have 3 million years to do it, does that mean I'm going to get there? No, even if it's mathematically possible for you to get there, you're going on, right? So you might end up what might take you 4 billion years to do it. In other words, even if I did it, would I get there? Even if it's mathematically possible, would I do it? No. So that's the same with evolution. Even if it were mathematically possible, that doesn't mean that it would have the mechanism to do it. Let's go ahead and wrap up here. I just wanted to give you a few terms with genetics. genes then are, genetics then is the study of heredity, how DNA is passed on to the next generation. And I think I'm going to skip some of this and go down to, I'm going to skip the history here. I'm going to go down to the definition of a gene. A gene is a section of DNA
that codes for a particular characteristic.
In other words, it codes for a particular polypeptide chain which will become a functional protein. That's basically the definition of a gene. In other words, the section of DNA, here we have our DNA molecule, the section of DNA that codes for a particular polypeptide chain, which becomes a functional protein, let's say it causes hair color, or it's several genes do that. But this section of DNA molecule determines my hair color. We call that a gene. See what I mean? So a gene is a section of DNA. Genes carry all the information needed to produce the physical traits that you and I possess. DNA is tightly wound. I always like to tell my students this. So if the DNA in a cell, if all the DNA, the total length of the DNA strand in one cell is 6 feet. Okay, so it's very tightly wound to get into one cell. If you unwrapped it, it would probably be 6 feet. But all the DNA in our body, if they're bunched together, it can fit into a box, the size of an ice cube. Okay. But if you unstretch all the DNA in our body, all however many trillion cells we have, it would stretch from the Earth to the Sun back more than 400 times. So that's 93 million miles, right? So the DNA in our body, if we stretched it out, one cell now, 6 feet, so I'm not going to do the calculation, but from the Earth to the Sun back about 400 times. So when someone says, I feel all wound up today, you can tell, well, you probably are all wound up today. So if the coded DNA instructions in a single cell were put into English, in one cell of our body, all the DNA contains, it would fill a 1,000-volume encyclopedia. So, again, these facts become staggering. Now, what is a chromosome? Chromosomes are long strands of DNA. In other words, the DNA in our cells are orderly. They're arranged orderly. And when a cell divides, the DNA bunches up. It coils up. And that's when you see the functional, that's when you see the characteristic chromosome shape. So whenever you go through your books and you see, you know, this, when you see that, skip all that, characteristic chromosome, you call it, right? Well, what is a chromosome? Well, a chromosome is a strand of DNA that has ordered itself just before it has to divide. In this particular case, before division, this would have been one strand of DNA. It has now replicated itself, and whenever it does that, it bunches up. And that's when we can see the characteristic chromosomes in an organism. So in your body and mine, unless the cell is dividing, you won't see the DNA. It's too thin, strand, right? I mean, it's still wound up. I mean, 6 feet fits in one cell, right? But before it divides, then it really gets bunched up. I have a micrograph I'm gonna throw some terms out here without defining them. I have a micrograph of mitosis, and you can, see the DNA emerge. Okay, here's in a normal cell. Okay, you can still see it starting to get dark. But here the DNA is starting to bunch up. And those would be chromosomes, each of these. And then they're being replicated. The main thing I wanted to share here in closing is that I wanted to go over mitosis and meiosis, and that's really all
all I'm going to do. And then we're going to talk about a few things. I want to ask you a few questions. But mitosis is, and students always have a hard time remembering which is which, mitosis and mitosis. So they can't. Just, here's another line of gate. Mitosis. So mitosis is when a cell divides before it divides equally, and both are the same. The two long cells are identical. Mitosis, and two toes are the same. Whereas meiosis, you have another. You have two. Meiosis is used in sexual reproduction, and I'm not going to go there. Where you have to, in our cell, in the cell in our body, how many chromosomes do we have? We have 23 pairs, 46 chromosomes. We get one pair from our father, one pair from our mother. Okay. So when a zygote develops, fertilization of egg on the sperm cell contributes 23 chromosomes, the egg cell contributes 23 chromosomes. Together, you get 46. That's called diploid number. So if meiosis did not occur, every successive generation would double the chromosome number. So the meiosis halves the chromosome number. So that's how you can help your students remember. Meiosis, and you have only half the chromosome. Meiosis, you have two developed cells that are the same.
That's kind of where I'm going to wrap up here. I wanted to get your thoughts too on the end here. What are some things you found interesting or helpful in going through DNA and heredity? I didn't touch heredity very much.
Students, once you get them into it, they love it. Give them pump squares, give them crosses, sex-linked crosses on characteristics. Give them understand why the X, why some characteristics are sex-linked, because the X and Y are linked. They love it, and then they start doing the forgetting, getting realistic, crosses. And you start giving older values, and recessive and dominant, and so on. So they love it once you get into it. But if you haven't weighed into it, it's going to be hard.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.